This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a Black activist announces her candidacy for the U.S. Senate at a Black is Back Coalition electoral politics school in St. Louis. A Black prosecutor in Virginia explains why it's important to make cops accountable when they kill unarmed people. And Mumia Abu-Jamal remembers Winnie Mandela. But first, activists took to the streets in cities around the country to protest the Sacramento police killing of Stephen Clark, an unarmed young Black man shot to death in his grandmother's backyard. Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly says the burst of protest activity is a good sign.
I was encouraged. You know, we should hear about police killings every day because they happen every day. Every year, little more than 1,000 people, an average of 3 people every day, are killed by the police. And one of those, on average, one of those people will be a Black person. So these protests should be constant. It's a good thing that the details of Stephon Clark's murder appeared in the media and that the community there in Sacramento, actually across the country, rose up in protest that this man was on his property in his yard. We now know the police body camera showed that they did not identify themselves as police. They started shooting as soon as they saw him. And of course, there's always a story about what he did or didn't have in his hand. And I think that's a detail we should not allow ourselves to get bogged down in, because it's only an issue for Black people. The weapon is having the brown skin. And the manner in which they killed him, that they went into the home where his grandmother was and questioned her to find out what she had seen or heard, and didn't say anything about shooting him. She looked out the window and saw his body. And those horrible details are things that we should know. It's important that these victims are not just swept under the rug and forgotten. And it's important that people in Sacramento and everywhere protest these killings, and that we come up with a new movement. Black Lives Matter is still, the term is still comes up when these killings become publicized, but it's a problematic organization to connect it with the Democratic Party and not connected enough with the masses of people. But their temporary limited success showed that we do need leadership. We do need organizations all over the country to speak up for people who literally cannot speak up for themselves anymore.
Speaking of the Democratic Party, that party's signature was all over many of the activities associated with March for Our Lives.
Well, yes, it was a Democratic Party event. It was bankrolled by rich people like Michael Bloomberg, former New York mayor, Eli Broad, and others. You can't turn around something like that. It was clearly a well-oiled, well-funded machine. And it's the sort of thing that the Democrats like. They don't really have to do anything. They get to take advantage of the popular anger over, in this case, school shooting in Florida. But they don't do anything about state violence domestically by the police, by our military abroad. And they don't talk about the why of violence in this country, the why of the Second Amendment, that this was a tool of the slave patrol. And it's interesting, I think we're the only country that claims that there is a right to bear arms, but the U.S. was unique, this settler colonial state where the enslaved population had to be managed. And the native population also had to be subjugated. And 200 years later, after the Constitution is written, that's still what happens in this country. We still have a slave patrol. They're called the police, the NYPD or the LAPD or whatever PD. They are the slave patrol. But that's not something that anybody talks about. It is important that people talk about the fact that these assault weapons, this AR-15 that killed those kids in Florida, the fact that they should be illegal, that that's a military weapon, And it should not be in the hands of any, there's no reason for any private citizen to own a weapon like that. And that's a legitimate point to make. But to talk about the larger issue of violence in this country, why it's so concentrated, why there are so many white men who want to own guns. We have a concentration of weaponry now where there are fewer people who have guns, but the people who have them have a lot. So there are people who have arsenals. They haven't carried out a school shooting or a Las Vegas type shooting that happened a few months ago. But we have millions of people in this country who are ready to kill. And the reasons for it are that's something that most people aren't, that many people who marched in this March for Our Lives don't want to talk about. And that's the issue of whiteness and the need for white, many white people to feel like they have control and literal physical control over other people, or the right to kill if they want to kill. So those are the things that have to be talked about. And of course, the Democrats aren't interested in that at all.
And of course, white people per capita have many more guns than black folks. However, every time there's a crackdown on guns, it's black folks who are getting arrested.
Of course, that's the whole purpose of the criminal justice, the criminal injustice system is what we should call it. White people use drugs just as much as, I believe, more than black people do. But who are the people who got the draconian sentences? There's no difference between powder cocaine and crack cocaine. But then Congress legalized these disparities and people went to jail for decades, some of them still locked up. So, yes, it's drugs or guns or deadbeat dads or anything that we're whipped into a frenzy of fear and hate over is directed at black people. So it will be, and any crackdown on gun ownership will be directed at black people and not at the white people, the ones who have the concentration of firearms.
Isn't it amazing that in the United States, the only right that is popularly recognized is the right to bear arms, not the right to health care, not the right to housing, not the right to a job, not even a right to live?
That's true. It's true. And the other, the rights that we are given are ignored and abused, the right to assemble freely. That means we ought to be planning a mass movements over a variety of issues. Our right against illegal search and seizure is being whittled away by the Supreme Court. So we essentially don't have that right anymore. The right to free speech is more about the government monitoring speech and not anybody else. Our employers or a variety of forces can keep us from speaking our minds the way we want to. The press, the corporate media, they in effect do away with our right to speak freely by just ignoring anyone who steps outside of the confines of what is considered acceptable discourse. But yes, people go on and on about the right to carry a gun and never consider adding about the rights I just mentioned or that you mentioned that we should have, and many other countries, where people have the right to those very fundamental things that we need to survive in civilized society, which Americans love to talk about being civilized, but it doesn't seem to amount to much.
And this right to bear arms for individuals in the United States seems to be reflected on a global scale where the United States appears to reserve the right to use deadly force against other nations and peoples exclusively, that it is its exceptional right.
Yes, this whole notion of America being exceptional is a very, very dangerous one. It's something Obama used to say a lot, I noticed, more than other presidents, that America was exceptional and indispensable. And that means the rest of the world is dispensable. So anytime the United States, the right people, the military, the ruling class, whomever, decide to attack anybody in the world, America can do that. If it's inconvenient, then you make up lies. You say that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction or Muammar Gaddafi had given Viagra to his troops so they could rape at will. Or now that Vladimir Putin has done all manner of evil and, you know, undid our elections and poisoned people and anything. and everything. So if the moment comes that to have a military confrontation, that people won't question it. So, and most people do not, even people who are call themselves liberal. That's why there's so much propaganda. If enough of a case is made that another country is bad or wrong, then this exceptional country, which has rights that no one else seems to have, can do what it wants. And that's another reason that people feel that they have the right to have guns. It filters down. We have a state that says it has the right to exact violence anytime it wants to. And of course, that filters down to individuals.
And the United States appears to think that it can farm out that exceptionalism and the privileges that go with it to its junior partners like Israel.
Absolutely. The occupation continues. Last week we saw a massacre. The corporate media, with their lying, said there were clashes between Israelis and Palestinians. I don't know what kind of clash you have when all the dead people are on one side and they're the side who are unarmed, but the United States gets to designate partners in crime. And Israel is among the worst, and they also have a powerful domestic lobby here, making the case for themselves. So politicians and the corporate media, likewise, even certain so-called human rights organizations make excuses for Israel's brutality and for the apartheid state. So it could be Israel or it could be Saudi Arabia, any of the Western, I'm putting that in quotes, NATO members who are like a little gang, and they too get to join in the exceptionalism and destroy Libya or surround Russia or the bidding of the United States in some other way.
Now, President Trump said earlier this week that he wants the United States to get out of Syria. But then his generals jumped up and said, not so quick. What's up there?
Well, it's kind of confusing. You know, Trump, I think that's his true inclination. That's the sort of thing he talked about when he was campaigning. Of course, when one becomes president, they're overruled by the military or any number of factions among the rulers, but that happened with Obama too, who was taking some steps towards some sort of rapprochement with Russia, but then the military bombed Syrian troops and ruined this nascent deal with Putin. So this has happened before. So we have presidents who don't run everything. It's very interesting. But who knows with Trump? The United States should not be in Syria. The United States should never have intervened in the affairs of that country. It was wrong to begin with, but it's unlikely that the United States will disengage completely. You have the French troops involved. Turkey plays both sides of this conflict. So it's unlikely that even if that's what Trump wants to do, that the U.S. will disengage. But that's very, very unfortunate. This is a war that actually has been won. The Syrian army held it together, and with the help of their allies, Iran and Russia, pushed ISIS and other jihadists out of Syria. But the United States refuses, and its allies, such as Saudi Arabia, one of those designated with the right to kill people in Syria or Yemen or wherever they want, refuse to give up, and the suffering of the Syrian people goes on.
And whatever the resistance to Trump is about, it certainly is not about anti-war or peace sentiment.
No, it's just anti-Trump. It's anti-Republican and it's anti-Trump. Trump has this particular ability. He's such a repulsive person that people focus on him as an individual. I think there's still this trauma that he is president. It wasn't supposed to happen. And yet there he is, the president of the United States, having defeated the person who we are told was inevitable and it was her turn. And we don't know, the elections in this country are so crooked. The vote theft, the very literal machinery can be scammed. People go on and on about Russia, but it's Americans who steal votes through a variety of methods. It's an anti-Trump sentiment. And we've seen this before, where people who marched 15 years ago in 2003 against the war against Iraq folded their tents when Barack Obama came along, who was not anti-war. So that effort, as large as it was, turned out to be more of an anti-Republican effort more than it was an anti-war effort. Trump, because he is Trump, because of who he is, because he's a Republican, there are people who will be aghast when he says he'll have the mother of all bombs or claims he'll exact fire and fury against North Korea, but they're still not anti-war. And then some of those same people, when Trump said he would talk to Kim Jong-un in North Korea, criticized him for a variety of reasons. So they showed their true colors in that respect.
As you say, the Democrats said that Trump was not supposed to happen, and they blame people like you and me for that happening.
Of course they do. It was a day of reckoning for the Democrats. They, aside from electing Obama, they failed at everything else. They lost both houses of Congress. They lost control of most state legislatures. Hillary Clinton had $1 billion and could not eke out an electoral college victory. And they don't want to talk about that. Well, there's several things going on. They don't want to talk about their failures that led to Trump winning. And of course, they always want to silence the left. So it's very convenient for them to go on and on and on about Russia because they don't want anybody to ask what happened. I know Hillary Clinton wrote some silly book where she basically made excuses for herself and settled scores, but there has been very little discussion of what happened and how the Democrats' failure ended up with Trump in the White House. And of course, we are very convenient scapegoats because we were never in their camp to begin with. And we encourage people to leave the Democratic Party. And we point out the bankruptcy of the Democrats and how we lose even when they win, we still lose. And we tell people the truth about the terrible things that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama did, putting people in jail, the wars, getting rid of public assistance, all kinds of things that were so terrible and ruined black people's lives. So, of course, they want to come at us. So they get a twofer. We get to be blamed for Donald Trump being president, and they get to, they hope, shut us up for good.
Well, this anti-Russia hysteria has been going on for more than a year and a half now, resulting in a shrinking of access to the internet by sites and individuals and organizations that have been targeted as somehow part of the large Russia connection. In this current age, a freedom of speech without freedom of access to and the ability to speak through the internet really cannot exist.
It cannot. And we've talked about this. I know Bruce Dixon has talked about it a lot. We've become dependent on the internet because it was a way to level the playing field somewhat, where everyone had access potentially to whomever they wanted to communicate with. But now we and other sites have been attacked by Google and by Facebook. And we've all experienced trying to search for things we know we've written and they don't come up on Google like they used to. And Facebook has been under pressure with this ginned up story of Russian bots. And they have succumbed. So these platforms that we have depended on are very unreliable. So we've got to think about other ways to communicate with people. We may have to go back to, email, which seems so ancient at this juncture in history. But yes, it's a very deliberate effort. And unfortunately, it has succeeded in minimizing access for us and for others on the left, those labeled as pro-Russian or whatever term they use that's convenient at the moment. Vladimir Putin, if he didn't exist, would have to be invented because these people are using him to get away with quite a lot.
That was Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. In St. Louis, Missouri, over the weekend, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held a school on electoral politics to promote transformational change. One of those on hand was Coffee Wright, a longtime activist who's running for the U.S. Senate from Missouri.
I'm running against 20 rich white folk. I'm the only Black in the race. I am running on the Democratic Party, but I'm running with the morals and values. It's millions versus morals is what I say. I'm definitely supporting the Black agenda. I'm definitely supporting the 19 points for self-determination. It's on my posters, it's on my flyers, it's on my website, and I ain't scared to say it. I'm beyond being sick and tired of being sick and tired. I go down to the city workhouse and I speak to our brothers and sisters, and I see a lot of them locked up because they can't post $500 bail. They're taken away from their families during a year down at the workhouse. Where are their children? Put in homes so they can, so the system can capitalize off of that, and lost their jobs, then lost their homes and their apartments or whatever, and all of this over traffic violations, all this over selling small amounts of marijuana, nonviolent offenders doing 5 to 10 years in prison, nonviolent offenders. My son was one of those. He was speeding. They tried to give him 5 to 8 years for speeding. Yeah, he was guilty. He was going 140 in a 65-mile zone. So, yeah, he need to, it's some you know, repercussion behind it. But 5 to 8 years, no priors, no drugs, no weapons, no nothing. And, you know, and this was just a year ago. You know, driving down to St. Louis to see me for April Fool's Day. You know? And, but what sad me, I mean, we end up getting him. I say, people say we beat it. We didn't beat it because he got probation behind it. And they tried to make it a felony. And it cost me $10,000 just to make it a misdemeanor, and he still had to do paper pickup and community service. But how many of our young brothers and sisters is still locked up behind crazy madness like that? So I am totally against mass incarceration. We have to get our people out here on the streets working, get the families back together. We cannot continue the way America has been operating. I'm running on the Democratic Party, but my rules, morals, and values or for my people, 200%. I'm not looking for a job. I done did pretty much everything I wanted to do. I done worked in every capacity. Just ran into an old friend that sold insurance with me. He'll tell you, I was president club 3 years. Haven't seen him in 30 years. Sitting right back there. So I didn't, you know, I was a flight attendant. I'm a filmmaker. I have an organization called Slice. I'm a, you know, where it's the arts. I believe everybody has a story to tell, so I want to do everybody's movie. I want to help everybody do their book. You know, nobody takes this to the grave. The thing is that I'm not looking for a job, but I am willing to do the job. And I'm going to stick with it. I stand on my grounds. As Zaki said, you know, I've been working out here searching for the missing, and we did find. We found the body, the remains of Monica Seitz and others, because we found 2 left legs, and she didn't have both. But our police department don't even have a missing person division. What's up with that? We got 1,000 missing people right here in the state of Missouri. I've been out there with the Mike Brown and all these injustices. I was even in California doing the Rodney King. So this is not new to me. I've been speaking up since I've been a baby. I probably got more whoopings in my household than anybody. But the thing is that I'm going to fight for our people. I'm going to fight for our people. And I'm going to fight for our people till the day I die. Power to the people.
That was Coffee Wright, a candidate for the U.S. Senate from Missouri. Her campaign was endorsed by the Black is Back Coalition. Members of the National Black Caucus of Young Elected Officials Network held a press conference last week demanding local and national political reforms in the wake of the police killing of Stephen Clark. One of the officials on hand was Stephanie Morales, the young Commonwealth's attorney for Portsmouth, Virginia, who successfully prosecuted a police officer for killing an unarmed young Black man. Morales handled the case herself.
I felt it my responsibility to prosecute this case after a review of the facts, after an investigation that was conducted by the state police at my request, and along with the request of my police chief. And I felt it necessary that I prosecuted the case myself so that my community would have trust in the process. And ultimately, after a year of motions, and a week-long jury trial, there was a conviction for this police officer for the voluntary manslaughter of an unarmed African-American teen. Basically, what is happening around the nation is very concerning to me as a prosecutor. I think that many people don't understand what standard applies in determining whether or not a use of force should be justified or not. But ultimately, what is most concerning is that prosecutors or police officers are not the judge, jury, and executioner. There is a finder of fact that should be involved in all of these cases, and that is not happening. And ultimately, if decisions are being made by prosecutors where justification is made, there should be public accountability in the form of a report by the prosecutor that analyzes the facts and the law, or in the alternative, if the state law allows it, that the prosecutor could actually ask the grand jury to render a report.
You seem to be saying that often prosecutors don't exercise due diligence in utilizing the law against police officers, and that the problem's not just defects in the standard for charging police with unjustified lethal use of force.
That's correct. I think that as prosecutors, we have to take some responsibility for how we handle the cases. We cannot be, as elected prosecutors, victims of the law. We cannot say, we want to do this, but the law doesn't allow it. That's simply not the case. Otherwise, I would not have been able to take my case to a grand jury, secure indictments, and then carry the case forward to trial and ultimately have a jury to decide that this person was guilty of killing this unarmed African-American teen. And there are other instances around the country where there have been convictions as well. And so if some of us are able to do it and successfully protect their communities and be accountable, and even in instances where the cases can be deemed justified, if we can handle it in a manner such that we're accountable, we provide reports, we provide detailed information, and we try to be as transparent as possible, there's no reason why others can just say, well, I'm not allowed to share this information. I can't do it. It can't be done. It's not true. It's not necessarily what we want to do as prosecutors, to say to our colleagues that they're not doing something the right way. But anyone who is making the allegation that it simply can never be done because of the state of the law, I would have to disagree with that.
So when folks say that the law is rigged and it's just impossible to get a conviction against a police officer, you're saying, no, it's the prosecutors often who are unwilling, don't have the political will to prosecute.
Well, it's hard when I get asked a question like that, because I have been in that position, and I'm not speaking from a place where I said, we're going to go forth and prosecute this case, and then I gave it to one of my assistants. I actually prosecuted this case as the first chair myself. So this is something that I felt very strongly about, and I felt that as a leader of the office, I wasn't going to ask my team to do anything I wouldn't do myself, and that since this was the first time it was happening under my administration, I would step out and I would prosecute this case from beginning to end. I would step in from the day the shooting happened at the scene. So I simply just feel that as prosecutors, we cannot hide behind the law. Now, I won't say that the law makes it easy. I don't think I've ever said anywhere that this entire process was easy, because first of all, there's a loss of life, and his family and our community was hurt. And, you know, also there was a concern about just fairness to all parties. So nothing about it is easy. Nothing about the law is easy. But I don't think if you're signing up to be an elected official and for a life of public service that you signed up for something that's going to be easy. So I would never say that the state of the law is such that it's easy, but I will not agree that it cannot be done.
That was Portsmouth, Virginia Commonwealth's Attorney Stephanie Morales. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Mario Cuomo are demanding that the State Parole Board reverse its decision to parole Herman Bell, the former Black Panther who's been in prison for almost four decades in the killing of a cop. Ralph Pointer is an activist with the New Abolitionist Movement and the husband of the late people's lawyer and political prisoner Lynn Stewart. Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio say that no one that kills a cop should ever go free. But Ralph Pointer says these two politicians should pay a heavy price for trying to keep Herman Bell in prison.
I think that their conduct during this situation should end their political career. They should be marked done by the Black community. And the Black community that doesn't mark them as done as, you know, like a stick and a fork in them and turn them over, are the people that we must recognize as the outright enemy. What did they think the movements of the 60s were all about? And too often, they thought of them as a stepping stone for themselves, never mind the brave, and as Lynn Stewart called them, they are the ones, the braver soldiers among us, that gave we weaker soldiers space to operate in. It is just a tragedy that these guys have no fear of the Black Allegiance. The Democrats have no fear of losing it. That was pathetic. The way they thought that they were going to move their political career forward, and the public at large, to the point of 84-85% said freedom.
You say 84-85% of the public said freedom. You're talking about a poll that was taken. Could you explain?
Yes. There was a poll. Someone got the bright idea in a right-wing newspaper to make it a public issue, thinking that the public would be outraged at the idea of Herman Bal Jalil Montcalm being paroled. And it backfired. 84% of the people who voted to free them. Because I guess 84% of the people are in recognition of what America has gotten to be, and the fact that these brothers, you know, were just in that the oppressor cannot tell the oppressed how and when to fight for freedom. And so it's a double. We should have supported them a long time ago as the Puerto Rican people and the Puerto Rican politicians supported the Puerto Rican political prisoners. There were Black politicians who do not support Black political prisoners signed on to support Oscar Lopez Rivera. I mean, we are pathetic when it comes to political realities and political actions based on what's good for our people.
You were speaking of Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio not responding to Black community demands and the fact that many Black politicians aren't making these demands. But Cuomo and de Blasio seem to be quite responsive to the Fraternal Order of Police.
Exactly. And I am still smoking over that situation of the Fraternal Order of Police alliance with Democrats, and I cannot but think of Marilyn Zuniga, who represented everything we want in those who are teaching our children, who are supposed to be teaching our children. And when in East Orange, New Jersey, a Black school board appointed by the mayor fired Marilyn Zuniga for writing a get-well card to Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the response of the Black politicians was zero. Response of the unions was zero. And she is now teaching in California. And the representatives of teachers suggested that she resign.
Mutulu Shakur, a Black political prisoner who's been repeatedly denied parole, is suing the U.S. government, charging that he's been illegally held in prison.
True enough. Mutulu, when I hear the word Mutulu, Lynn always commented, she wrote to Mutulu, she loved Mutulu, and he's been removed. Who do we lay this to the blame of? How do we allow Mutulu, a doctor who was in the process of healing drug addicts with acupuncture, beside his being such a wonderful human being, and we have forgotten him? It just breaks your heart. I'm speechless. when I think of our lack of support for Betulu, and that he has to do it on his own by suing this government. When talking before Oscar was out and going to meetings with supporters of Puerto Rican political prisoners, a Puerto Rican gentleman said to me, Ralph, your struggle has an advantage over our struggle for Puerto Rican political prisoners. And I asked him, how so? And he says, black people as a group are more sophisticated politically than Puerto Rican people as a group. And I says, if you don't understand the reality that Puerto Ricans know they're Puerto Rican, where black folk don't know or want to know that they are of color. And that's their advantage. Puerto Ricans know and want to be Puerto Ricans, where black people don't know or want to be of color.
That was Ralph Pointer of the New Abolitionist Movement. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, spoke on the passing of Winnie Mandela, the widow of the man who was once the world's best-known political prisoner.
She was born in 1936 and named Namzamo Winifred Madikizela, but the world would come to know this South African beauty as Winnie Mandela, the wife of African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela. Their lives, their struggles for freedom, dignity, and liberation from the racist ignominy known as apartheid, filled most of the 20th century. He, Nelson, labored under the eye of the harsh apartheid sun, breaking rocks in the prison yard, while she, Winnie, labored under the white state's total surveillance while she raised their children. While not widely known, her suffering included not only separation from her husband, but the cruel legality called banning, a South African censorship that outlawed her speech, not allowing her to quote her husband's words. Winnie, a lifelong rebel, ignored such law and proudly quoted Nelson, and she suffered her own imprisonment as well. She was banished to Bloemfontein, a white Afrikaner district, where the only blacks she saw were servants or cooks for white families. She continued to resist the racist government. The ANC was banned, and she wore the ANC colors as a headdress. And when, after Nelson's freedom, the marriage ended, she remained a powerful presence in South African life, loved by the nation's poor and dispossessed. For they knew, in their heart of hearts, that their struggle was her struggle. In her 1984 book, Part of My Soul Went With Him, Winnie Mandela wrote, I have ceased a long time ago to exist as an individual. The ideals, the political goals that I stand for, those are the ideals and goals of the people in this country. They cannot just forget their own ideals. My private self doesn't exist. Whatever they do to me, they do to the people of this country. Several years ago, when Nelson was being laid to rest, his third wife, Graça Machel Mandela, stumped in grief, was given a hug and a kiss to console her by his second wife, Winnie. Namzamo Winnie Mandela Madikizela, a class act to the very end, and a lifelong revolutionary.
Last week marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, the peace and justice advocate. The week also saw Israeli troops mow down nearly a score of Palestinian protesters in Gaza. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
On Good Friday, 30,000 Palestinians staged a peaceful and nonviolent march to a spot next to the infamous Israeli apartheid wall for a series of picnics and protests, which they called the Great March of Return. Return refers to their righteous ambition to go back to the lands from which the U.S. armed and financed apartheid state of Israel has dispossessed them. From a fortified position on the other side of the wall, Israeli soldiers of the so-called Israeli Defense Force opened fire upon the peaceful unarmed crowd with lethal weapons, injuring somewhere between 700 and 1,000 Palestinians and murdering 17. In a Twitter post that was soon taken down, the IDF proclaimed that soldiers defended themselves against a terrorist mob and that they knew where every bullet landed. Israeli authorities have announced there will be no investigation of possible wrongdoing. As in Ferguson or Sacramento, the settler state's enforcers enjoy immunity and impunity. Like previous massacres in Gaza, this one was scarcely covered at all in the United States, though it's been front-page news for days across the rest of the planet. You can bet, though, that members of the Congressional Black Caucus and other leading members of the black political class in this country knew about it. However, you will search in vain for statements condemning this or previous Israeli massacres in Gaza from the Congressional Black Caucus, or for the most part, from its individual members. The omission is all the more glaring at the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, observed in Memphis and around the country this week. For several years, Dr. King and his work were lauded and praised to the skies by the U.S. corporate media. He was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize, and he enjoyed friendly access to the White House. This was because U.S. ruling circles fully endorsed the dismantling of Southern Jim Crow as necessary to America's image around the world and to its conflict with the Soviet Union, which was actively aiding liberation movements in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. But in April 1967, Dr. King directly, explicitly, and unmistakably confronted and denounced the current U.S. genocidal war in Vietnam, which would eventually kill 3 million Vietnamese. King accurately predicted further U.S. colonial wars in Asia, Africa, and the Americas in the coming decades, and he observed that economic and social justice inside the U.S. were unobtainable amid the wars needed to preserve U.S. global empire. Instantly, the entire apparatus of U.S. media turned upon him, and he went from one of the most admired Americans to becoming one of the most despised. As Cornel West correctly observes, most of the institutions and people writing checks and commemorating his death this week would never allow the Dr. King of his final year or a Dr. King of today at their podiums, at their pulpits, or on their airwaves. Nobody embodies this transparent hypocrisy more than our Congressional Black Caucus. Nobody observes, celebrates, and commemorates the seminal moments and victories of the freedom movement of a half century and more back with more diligence and dedication than our black political class. But their observances and commemorations are mere branding, by which they hope to attach the air of the bygone movement to their shallow and self-serving careers. When Gaza was bombed and devastated twice during the Obama era, CBC members unanimously voted to rearm Israel, as they do each and every year. When Netanyahu addressed the Congress, they only walked out because he insulted President Obama, not because he practices ethnic cleansing against Palestinians. While the CBC finally did bestir itself last month to meekly question Israel's policy of mass deportation of African immigrants, it has always been silent upon the larger matters of Israeli apartheid, on the daily violence which maintains it, and on the indispensable arms, public relations, financial, and diplomatic support rendered by Republican and Democratic parties alike. Dr. King was an honest man. If he were alive today, he would have to come to grip with the fact that no settler colonial regime has ever been overthrown by nonviolent means alone. We'll never know how or whether he could square that particular circle, but it's absolutely certain that he would mercilessly excoriate the U.S. enforcers and enablers of apartheid Israel, Republican and Democrat, white and black alike. That's called solidarity. And it's easy to imagine that he would reserve special and biting scorn and mockery for the black political class, which have erased the substance of his life's work and turned them into a mere corporate brand. Someday, Palestinians and all those who live in what is now the State of Israel will, with the help of outside forces, make a government and a society that represents all who lives there. That's what 30,000 Palestinians marched for on Land Day last Friday. Dr. King would have been with them, not at these hollow celebrations of his death.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.